turned out to be just the two of us, seated at a small oval table in the center of the green room. Two Navy stewards waited on us, only entering the room to serve food and drinks. The president began by asking me whether I wanted to stay on as FBI director, which I found strange because he had already told me twice in earlier conversations that he hoped I would stay, and I had assured him that I intended to. He said that lots of people wanted my job, and given the abuse I had taken during the previous year, he would understand if I wanted to walk away.
The words of former FBI Director James Comey as prepared for his opening statement tomorrow on Capitol Hill. Comey will testify before the Senate Intelligence Committee on Russia, President Trump, Michael Flynn, and the rest of the threads that have captivated the political world. Here to talk through that opening statement is Josh Barrow, host of KCRW's Left, Right, and Center, and senior editor at Business Insider. Hi, Josh.
Hi, Madeline. How are you?
I'm great. Well, how is it that the statement came out, 24 hours before he's actually going to give it?
Yeah, well, so that ensures that tomorrow morning's newspaper headlines will be about Comey's testimony, stepping on Infrastructure Week and whatever else people might have been talking about. Although, of course, we had the hearing this morning with Director of National Intelligence Dan Coats and others talking about this issue. But it basically allows Comey to drive two news cycles instead of one. And I think there are several interesting things we learn in this memo, a couple of which are confirmations of things that we'd already seen reported in press but had not yet seen directly from the mouth of James Comey. One is this request from the president to him basically saying, I hope you can let this go regarding at least the Mike Flynn aspect of the Russia investigation. Another is the president's request from Comey for an expression of his loyalty.
Mm-hmm.
And then finally, I think I think it's interesting to see in this memo this repeated discussion of lifting a cloud. The president basically was very concerned that the ongoing knowledge of the Russia investigation was impeding with his ability to make deals with the United States. We've seen this reporting in press over the last couple of weeks that early in the administration, the Trump administration had been exploring ways to lift sanctions against Russia. That obviously became untenable after February with Mike Flynn having to resign for having lied about his interactions with the Russian ambassador. The president really wanted a public statement from Jim Comey that he was not a target of the investigation. And one thing Comey points out in this memo is that a reason that he wouldn't make that statement public, even though he does confirm that he made that statement privately to the president on a number of occasions, is that if he went out and said that the president is not the subject of the investigation, and then later on the president were to become a subject of the investigation, that would create a duty to report. He'd have to go back out there and say, actually, we are investigating the president, very similar to, you know, that the letter that he released about 10 days before the election saying, actually, we are looking at a new thing regarding Hillary Clinton's emails. So in a way, this was to protect the president, that,
right.
That if Comey announced we're not looking at Trump, and then they did have to look at Trump later, they'd have to tell everyone that.
Right, right. So Trump obviously didn't see it that way, at least in the immediate sense. And he was kept pressuring Comey to declare his loyalty to him, at least according to Comey's account in this memo. I'm struck by the amount of times that they actually had conversations. At the beginning, Comey says he met with Trump 9 times or talked with him 9 times, either on the phone or in meetings. I think there were 3 in-person meetings. He had only met with President Obama 2x in the entire 8 years, including, and the last one was just to say goodbye at the end of 2016.
Yeah, I mean, and that's the way things are supposed to work. Even though the FBI director ultimately reports to the president and the president has the legal authority to fire the FBI director if he wishes, there are a number of norms and policies that are set up to keep the president from having direct involvement in the FBI's activities. And part of those norms and rules results in the president having very little direct interaction with the FBI director, especially on a one-on-one basis. But I think, you know, you can look at 40 years of Donald Trump's career, and Donald Trump doesn't think rules like that apply to him. I mean, my favorite example is during the presidential primary campaign when the RNC made all the candidates sign these loyalty pledges that they would support the nominee. They created that pledge because they were afraid Trump wouldn't do that if he didn't get nominated. Then he signs it, and then when he thinks he's not going to win, he says, well, you know, they've been very unfair to me, and I don't know that I need to follow this if they're not fair to me. And then it becomes clear that he is going to win, and he goes around and says, well, they're talking about not endorsing me, and that's terribly unfair, and they signed a pledge, and they have to support me. So I think, you know, Donald Trump's track record when, you know, whether he's repaying a lender or paying a contractor or being president of the United States is that rules apply to him when it's convenient and rules don't apply to him when it's not convenient. So it would make sense that he would ignore any strictures that are supposed to exist around his interactions with the FBI director.
Right. And so his supporters are saying, well, maybe this is just a political neophyte who doesn't know the rules. He doesn't know what he should and shouldn't be doing when it comes to discussing matters with an FBI director, and that it's not necessarily veering into obstruction of justice, just someone who doesn't really know what's what.
Well, there are two problems with that. One is, you know, in a legal case, you have what's called a mens rea standard, which is basically that you have to know you're doing the wrong thing in order to be culpable for the crime. But all that means is you have to know that you're doing the thing that's illegal. You don't have to know that it is illegal. So long as Trump knew that he was trying to get Comey to stop the investigation into Flynn, so long as that was his corrupt intent to interfere with the investigation, then that can be obstruction of justice, even if Donald Trump does not realize that what he's doing is a crime. But the other thing I'd note is that, you know, there's not going to be a criminal prosecution of Donald Trump here. He's the president of the United States. You can indict him. The remedy that exists when he abuses his power in this way is the impeachment power. And so Congress is allowed to define high crimes and misdemeanors as sees fit. It doesn't need to use the same standard that would be used in a legal indictment to figure out whether the president obstructed justice or not.
Right. Meanwhile, you have, as you mentioned earlier, this hearing today at the Senate with Dan Coats and Mike Pompeo. And the Washington Post today saying that Trump did ask Coats and maybe Pompeo to intervene with James Comey and ask him to back off the focus of the Mike Flynn in the Russia investigation. I just want to play an exchange between a couple of the senators in these two at today's hearing.
Why are you not answering the questions? Is it an invocation of executive privilege? If there is, then let's know about it. If there isn't, answer the questions.
I stand by the comments I've made. I'm not interested in repeating myself, sir. And I don't mean that in a contentious way.
Well, I do mean it in a contentious way. I don't understand why you're not.
Do you want to tell us any more about the Russian involvement in our election that we don't already know from reading the Washington Post?
I don't think that's a position that I'm in. I do know that there are ongoing investigations.
Okay, that was actually Mike Rogers. I misspoke when I said Mike Pompeo. And so what do you make of that, though? They're not answering the questions versus what seems to be a very open explanation, shall we say, no holds barred explanation from James Comey in his opening statement.
Yeah, that was clearly frustrating to a lot of the senators on both sides of the aisle, including the Republican chairman of the committee, Richard Burr, who at the end of the hearing made a statement basically about how it's unacceptable for them to come to the committee unprepared to give answers to questions. They were basically asked repeatedly, you know, well, why aren't you answering? Are you asserting executive privilege? Are you claiming that this conversation was classified? Because it doesn't seem like it would be a classified matter whether the president was trying to interfere to stop an investigation whose existence has been widely reported and is not a classified matter. And they basically, several of the witnesses just kept saying things like, they don't think it's appropriate to discuss it. Andrew McCabe, who's the acting director of the FBI, and Rod Rosenstein, who's the deputy attorney general, made statements to the effect that they didn't want to get in the way of the investigation by special prosecutor Robert Mueller. But then they also said that they hadn't actually talked with Robert Mueller about what the areas what subject areas would be within the purview of his investigation, which ones they were free to discuss. Ultimately, it's not clear that there's a lot that politically they can really do to force them to provide these answers. Dan Coats, who's the director of national intelligence, did indicate that it was likely he would be able to be more forthcoming with them in a closed session. Some of the members of the committee were indicating that they would like to have a closed session quickly with those people. So Congress may be able to be briefed more extensively on that, even if we don't get public statements on these matters from them soon. But of course, you know, they can be interviewed by Robert Mueller as part of the investigation, and that testimony could ultimately be public as well.
All right. Josh Barrow, senior editor at Business Insider, host of KCRW's Left, Right, and Center. Thanks, Josh.
Thank you.
All right. Well, at 4:44 a.m. this morning, President Trump tweeted, "I will be nominating Christopher A. Wray, a man of impeccable credentials, to be the new director of the FBI. Details to follow." Well, here with a few details is Garrett Graff. He's a national security journalist who covers the FBI, and he's the author of The Threat Matrix, The FBI at War. Hi there.
Good afternoon.
Who is Christopher Wray? You've interviewed him. What's he like?
Christopher Wray is about as traditional of an FBI director choice as we could have expected from Donald Trump. You know, through his process, you had a lot of career politicians, people like Joe Lieberman, John Cornyn, and Kelly Ayotte, rise to the top of the list. But there had been a lot of resistance to appointing a partisan official to that job. And so Christopher Wray's background, as it turns out, is pretty typical of what you would see of a normal FBI director in the past. Longtime Justice Department official, former federal prosecutor, and former head of the criminal division of the Department of Justice, a job that actually Bob Mueller himself held.
Well, he worked with Bob Mueller when he was FBI director and James Comey when he was assistant attorney general. So he knew and worked with both men. Does that help?
Yeah, and I think that that's actually the most surprising aspect of this choice from President Trump is that this is a man who learned a lot of what he knows about the FBI and the Department of Justice from Bob Mueller and Jim Comey, of course, the two central figures in this political maelstrom around the Russia investigation these days. Christopher Wray worked right alongside them in the upper ranks of the Justice Department in the years after 9/11, when Bob Mueller was FBI director and James Comey was the Deputy Attorney General. And he was right there in the midst of the very dramatic hospital bed showdown that some people might remember from March 2004, when James Comey and Bob Mueller picked a fight with Vice President Cheney and the Bush White House over the Stellar Wind NSA domestic surveillance program. Christopher Wray was actually one of the dozen top department officials who was prepared to resign if Bob Mueller and Jim Comey didn't get their way at that moment.
Which they did.
And we learned nothing of this dramatic incident for many years to come until the last dramatic testimony that Jim Comey made before the U.S. Congress.
All right. We also heard today that he represented New Jersey Governor Chris Christie in the aftermath of the Bridgegate scandal. What did he do for him there?
So this is one of the unique aspects that Christopher Wray brings in terms of a resume, is that he has spent most of the last decade as a criminal defense attorney, working for the very fancy Washington law firm King & Spalding. And that is not a background that we have ever seen before in an FBI director. I mean, normally the FBI would see appointing a criminal defense attorney to head the bureau as effectively putting a fox in charge of the hen house. But I think that given his impeccable credentials with the Department of Justice before his stint as a criminal defense attorney, we are likely to see him very warmly welcomed by the bureau and by Democrats on Capitol Hill.
What do you make of the politics of this or the timing of it that President Trump announces this nomination on the eve of James Comey's testimony?
Well, it's hard not to see this both as a distraction from tomorrow's Comey testimony, but also today's dramatic hearing that you have already played some tape from with the leaders of the national security agencies testifying in front of the Senate. And receiving a lot of questions on Russia and President Trump's involvement in that investigation. At the same time, though, this is a pick that has been long overdue and then found that the decision was turning out to be harder than he was anticipating. A lot of the top candidates dropped out, and it was only on Tuesday that he appears to have met for the last time with his two finalists, Christopher Wray and then John Pistol, who is a former FBI official and the former administrator of the TSA.
Now, when you interviewed him, Christopher Wray, you talked to him about the role of FBI director. And what was his conception of it in terms of its political independence?
Well, perhaps the most challenging aspect of Christopher Wray's job, given the way that he is stepping into it if he's ultimately confirmed, is navigating this position where the Department of Justice in general and the FBI very specifically, their client, the person that they are supposed to answer to, is actually supposed to be the Constitution, not any political office holder, not the Attorney General, and not the President of the United States. And that, of course, was a challenge for his predecessor, Jim Comey, because as far as we have seen from news reporting, and we'll probably hear some of this tomorrow, Donald Trump tried to exact a loyalty oath from Jim Comey when he took office back in January.
Garrett Graff, national security journalist. He covers the FBI. He's author of the new book, The Threat Matrix, The FBI at War. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
So we want to hear from you. What are your questions going into tomorrow's Jim Comey hearing? Let us know on our Facebook page or on our Twitter page at KCRW Press Play. Coming up, why prosecutors went after a mom-and-pop bank in New York's Chinatown in the wake of the mortgage crisis. We'll have that story next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. It's been a decade since the mortgage crisis and Great Recession that followed, and we still don't know how much was lost, at least financially. Was it $6 trillion, $10 trillion, $14 trillion? The government bailed out big banks like Goldman Sachs and JP Morgan Chase. One small bank didn't get so lucky. Abacus Federal Savings Bank was the only one that faced criminal charges. It was run by a family in New York's Chinatown. They aim to serve low-income communities there.
This case is about an attack on our community. We're easy prey. I think that's what's going on. People have reason to be fearful of authority or what can happen to them. It's more than just Abacus Savings Bank being clear. It's about exonerating our entire community. No matter what we do, be it the little guy selling vegetables or a bank that's doing business, I told Mr. Song, I'm glad they pick on you because you're a fighter.
That's community activist Don Lee in the new documentary Abacus, Small Enough to Jail. It opens in L.A. this Friday at the New Art Theater. I spoke earlier with director Steve James.
Great to be here.
Well, why don't you begin by telling us about this bank, Abacus? How was it created in the first place?
Well, it was created in 1985 by Thomas Sung, a Chinese immigrant who was a lawyer at the time, but discovered that when he tried to go to the banks and borrow money versus just deposit money, that it was very difficult for even him to do as a successful lawyer. You know, at the time, there was this sense that the banks weren't really equipped to even communicate with Chinese depositors. They didn't have people who spoke the language generally. And there was a suspicion, I think, that they were this sort of immigrant other and they would gladly take their money but didn't want to risk making loans to people. So Mr. Sung decided that he wanted to change that. And so instead of practicing law, he decided to become a banker. And he opened the small little community bank in Chinatown, Abacus. And they eventually expanded to six branches in three cities, but it's still, you know, a pretty small bank.
So how does this little bank get caught up in the mortgage crisis?
Well, I mean, first you have to understand that they didn't participate in any of the kind of nefarious vehicles and that the big banks did during that crisis. They saw that for what it was and declined to participate.
The credit default swaps and all that.
All that. So when the crash, you know, happened, it didn't affect them because they weren't doing any of that. But that didn't seem to matter to Cyrus Vance Jr., the DA of New York, who went in 2009. There was some fraud internally at Abacus that Abacus discovered and then took action on. They fired the loan officer and then initiated their own internal investigation, which they weren't required to do, which resulted in firing a couple of other people. And they dutifully reported all this to the regulators as they were required. And then it resulted, though, in the aggrieved mortgage borrower going to the police. And that set in motion a process by which the DA of New York decided that Abacus's officers and the head of the bank were involved in the fraud and endorsing the fraud and complicit in the fraud. And then he made a big spectacle of indicting them in 2012 and connecting what they had done to the 2008 crisis.
Well, this indictment and then the subsequent perp walk were really controversial. They're, you know, in front of the TV cameras, there was a parade of these employees, all of whom, I guess, were Chinese, Chinese American. I guess it upset a lot of people because they didn't do that very often when they made these arrests.
No. You know, one of the Sung daughters, who's a big part of the film, Chanterelle, she worked for D.A. Vance right up until right before the indictment. She was there that day in court when the perp walk happened, and she said that in her 7 years at the DA's office, she'd never seen anything like it. These were low-level loan officers or ex-loan officers being indicted for extremely petty fraud, and they were chained together and paraded down the hallway.
Here's a clip of Chanterelle reacting to that.
It made me so angry that that very same office where I had served and been trained could do that. To know that they were doing this against my family, who is me, that's where I come from. And then to know that my reputation in the office was one of utmost integrity, it just made no sense.
And so she quit the DA's office, right, and went to go work for her family and work on the case?
Yes. She decided that she needed to do everything she could to help her family through this.
And describe a little bit of the family, because it's not just Thomas Sung, it's also his daughters running it. He has four daughters?
He has four daughters, two of which work and still work in the bank. Jill is the president of the bank. Mr. Sung has, you know, retired, but he is on the board of directors and still very active in the bank. And then there's Vera Sung, another daughter who is vice president and oversees the mortgage loans. And Heather is the fourth daughter.
And she doesn't have anything to do with the bank?
No, she doesn't have anything to do with the bank.
But they are a really close-knit family, and this trial really brings them even closer.
Yeah, I mean, that was, for me as a filmmaker, I mean, the story is sort of this crazy case that on its own terms is worth making a documentary about, I think. But when I met the family, that's really what sold me on wanting to tell their story, because they are so close. They're so principled. They bicker at times about strategy, but they're so loving and devoted to one another, and especially to their father, that it's really something to have captured.
The trial lasted lasted 5 years. The trial itself lasted a couple of months. Why was it so long and involved?
Well, you know, they say the wheels of justice move slowly. I think the wheels of injustice move slowly as well, too. And one of the things that was so striking about the trial for us was, you know, in all those 8,000 pages of testimony from this trial, that the kind of fraud that was going on, for the most part, was of such a petty and small variety, it's hard to imagine that the DA's office would devote so much time and energy and money to pursuing it. A big part of the reason that DA Vance brought the case to begin with was that he had an ambition to be the guy that was going to prosecute a bank in the wake of the 2008 crisis. That had not happened.
But why didn't he go after the bigger banks who were more complicit?
Well, I think he didn't go after the bigger banks for a couple of reasons. One is that the Fed stepped in and sort of they were the ones to sort of direct any kind of indictments that were going to go on for the big banks. But it's also been argued that he didn't go after them because they're big banks in New York City and they are far more powerful and influential. And it would be quite a risk for him and for the city of New York to try to take them on. You know, there was definitely a feeling that Abacus, which served the Chinese-American community, which has historically not been politically active, that there were very few risks involved in going after a bank like Abacus, and it would have been a much different situation had he gone after one of the big banks.
Let's hear a clip of tape from him where he denies any kind of intimation or allegation that this, in fact, was a culturally biased prosecution.
I think the characterizations that this was somehow a cultural bias on the office's part, entirely misplaced and entirely wrong. We devote an enormous amount of effort into protecting immigrant communities, and I felt that our handling of the bank was consistent with how we would have handled the bank if we were investigating a bank that serviced the South American community or the Indian community. There was nothing different that we did or purposefully designed to treat this bank differently.
What kinds of, you're chuckling, what kinds of the cultural misunderstandings were there in this case, both in the prosecution and during the trial?
There was an unwillingness to consider the realities of doing banking in immigrant communities. And I'm not just talking about a Chinese-American community. That's what we're talking about in this particular case. But historically, immigrant communities in this country trying to gain a foothold here have usually begun at a place of the cash economy. And the whole act of trying to sort of, you know, buy a first house or start a business is how they begin to become assimilated into American culture. And the Abacus Bank folks understood this about their clientele and how they can, you know, determine whether someone is worthy of a loan or not. And so the prosecution seemed to ignore that completely. And so they sought to twist every possible irregularity that one would associate with banking in that community into a crime.
So the feds were saying, or the prosecution was saying in this case, you're not doing your due diligence, Abacus. You're not making sure that these are actual verifiable loans that are going to be paid back. You're not making sure that these borrowers have the assets, indeed, that they need to buy a home.
Yeah, that's what they're saying. But Abacus seems to be pretty good at their job because their mortgage default rate was 1/20th of the national average. They have one of the lowest default rates in the entire country. I mean, it was really interesting to me that when I asked Vance about comparing what Abacus was doing to what the big banks were doing, he said, well, the big banks were engaged in actions that could be called less than ethical. And I thought, wow, that's a really interesting way to refer to what the big banks were doing. And then he immediately said, but Abacus was doing that too.
So 5 years, millions of dollars spent, and really for what? Well, you got a movie out of it, so.
Yeah, I guess, yeah, that was a good thing. Well, you know, from the Sung's point of view, when we went in to ask them to, you know, if we could make this film, and they said yes. And I said to them, I said, look, two things you have to understand. One is that we're making this film regardless of the outcome of the trial. And two, you know, we're going to try to do our best to get the prosecution's case into this film against you. And whatever is compelling about that case is going to be in this film, and we're going to ask you about it. And they agreed to all of it immediately because they felt like this was an injustice. And they also felt like this case actually had something larger to say about their community and about injustice in this country as it relates to their community. And so I think they felt like there was a larger calling in allowing this film to go forward regardless of how it would turn out.
That's Steve James. He's the director of the documentary Abacus, Small Enough to Jail. It opens Friday at the New Art Theater. Coming up, actress Melissa Leo on playing a comedy club boss in a new TV series and why doing comedy is hard.
It's a fascinating and very, very high art and also very taxing of our blessed comics.
I'm Dying Up Here explores the highs and the many lows of stand-up comedy. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Stand-up comedy can be seriously painful. You tell jokes to an almost empty room. You bare your soul. You're heckled. Repeat. And behind the scenes, it might not be any better.
You think you can joke your way out of everything? Pain, heartache, life. Go ahead. Then what? It's all still there waiting for you, waiting to be dealt with.
The new Showtime series, I'm Dying Up Here, follows a group of young comedians struggling to make it big on the Sunset Strip in the 1970s. It stars Oscar-winning actress Melissa Leo. Michael Aguilar is executive producer of the show. They both stopped by our studios recently. One of the comics, I know this might be a spoiler, but this is airing after the debut, but your lead character, your leading man, handsome comic, commits suicide very early on in the first
episode. Well, now wait a second. She's spreading rumors already.
Yeah. Does he, or does he just step in front of a bus at a inopportune
moment?
Well,
he dies.
Moment?
Okay, so he dies. Yeah. He's gone. Your leading
bus
man.
Bus accident.
Yeah.
Yeah. So could be either or. But that's quite a way to start a show that's about
it's the show. Yeah, but that's the world. I mean, to us, it was, let's look at the height of getting on The Tonight Show and the highest high you can have in 1973. And that's not enough. And it is that pendulum of highs and lows of this world. I mean, we all expect comedians to always be funny and always be on, but it is a dark and painful road sometimes. And that to us was always... That's how we need to announce our show.
Mm. And Melissa, your character Goldie, she seems to realize that and take that to heart in a strange way, that she knows that she's dealing with people who could be mentally unbalanced.
Oh, she hopes they're a little mentally unbalanced.
Because that makes her better comedy?
Well, you got to tap into what Goldie knows, and she seems to know quite a bit about what's funny and what's not funny. And what she knows is that you do have to tap into that truth. And I would hazard a guess, and this is me, not her, that inside all of us there is a place that is quite dark. So tapping in and getting the truth out, you're going to get in that dark stuff, and that's where the funny lies. That's how it works, scientifically speaking.
Let's hear your character explain that.
Oh, they got mommy issues, they got daddy issues, they're about as stable as a Middle East ceasefire. That volatility, that pain, that willingness to walk out in front of a bus an hour after killing it on Johnny Carson, if that's what he did.
That's exactly what.
Well, that's the price of brilliance, isn't it?
Is she based on a real person?
Goldie is an homage to a woman, Mitzi Shore. She's not based on her because when I got invited to come and do the pilot, I didn't know who she was. And I, from Flabot's script, developed the character, you know, with the creative team. And it was 3 or 4 days into shooting the pilot that I realized, oh my gosh, this is, you know, a lot of the characters in the show are loosely based. Yeah. Do you use that word, based?
Yeah, I mean, we took, Bill Niedersader wrote a great book, and I think we took a lot of elements from it, but to try and tell the real story of all those comics, I mean, this is a show about a family, and that family wasn't those comics, you know, so it would have been impossible to kind of stay true to all of their stories. But there are certain elements, particularly Mitzi Shore being the only female comedy club owner, a female nightclub owner on the Sunset Strip in 73, very rare. The complications that immediately gives you were much more interesting. So we sort of went there. But as a human being, they're completely different. But as comedy pioneers, they're very similar.
If there were dozens of people like Mitzi Shore, I would not even mention her name.
Yeah.
But there's not. There's only one woman who did what Mitzi did.
Paint the scene, if you would, of the Sunset Strip comedy scene in the early 70s. What was it like?
Well, the biggest event was Johnny Carson moving The Tonight Show west in 72. And it's sort of hard to understand, but The Tonight Show was the golden ticket. There's nothing like that anymore. If you were anointed by Johnny, if you got the couch or even the okay sign, you had a career.
So the couch was after you did your
thing. If he invited you over for the couch, it was a big deal.
It was a day and age in which when The Tonight Show was on, if anybody in the United States was watching television, that's what they were watching.
Yeah.
Yeah. No DVR, no VHS, no internet.
It was just Carson.
Yeah. Yeah. And he was the tastemaker.
So if you got the couch, you were set.
You were set. You were set. You had a TV show the next day. You could open headline anywhere you wanted. It was that big a deal. So you've got...
It's like someone like Robin Williams would
absolutely
get on the couch.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's a very select group that got the couch the very first time they went. And Jim Carrey, who's obviously part of the show, did not get the couch the first time, but he got the okay sign, which was a big deal. So you've got all these comics coming from New York, coming from the East Coast, coming from Chicago to Los Angeles to be seen by Johnny's people. And it was just a collection of the greatest comics, I think, ever to do it in a moment when comedy was changing. You know, it wasn't joke.
set up punchline jokes. It was storytelling. It was therapy. It was characters. So it really was, you know, I sort of think about moments in our culture like the Seattle music scene or the art scene in the 50s and 60s in New York. It was that. It was that sort of important because you had so many prior Carlin, Leno and Letterman come in just around now. It's Elaine Boozler. Joan Rivers was already there. I mean, like this sort of endless, the icons of comedy and the inventors of modern stand-up.
And they would start out in clubs like Mitzi's / Goldie's Club.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah. And there was a couple clubs on the Strip and they would, you know, you'd start either open mic and get up early and trying to get on a list and hang out there all day. Then you'd pass your audition. And, you know, again, I think it was late '70s and Jim said he auditioned for Mitzi on the same night Bill Maher did, the two of them. And Bill had a tight set. Jim, not so tight. Jim walked out of the thing and went right back to Toronto and came back 2 years later. You know, I mean, it's that sort of that important, that cutthroat. I mean, he and obviously Jim's one of the icons of stand-up and became a legend at the Comedy Store. But it took a couple rounds. You know.
And so your character, based on Mitzi, has this eye, and she knows when the comics are ready to go to Carson and maybe get on the couch. She decides.
It's not that she decides. She can see. To her, it's obvious. She just gets it on almost a sort of scientific level, and she's not picking and choosing. They all think she's picking and choosing because she likes one better than the other or because she wants something from. She's just looking for where the funny is at all times and has a very good barometer for that, a barometer that in our story Carson respects like nobody else.
But as Michael said, the standards of comedy were changing right then from telling a, you know, how did I get here? Who's my wife? Take my wife, please. Yeah. That kind of Henny Youngman type of comedy too, this narrative.
And it's what one of the things that's really exciting about the creative team that we worked with is there's a lot of things from Goldie's youth that are included in her reality, the way she dresses and things like that. She didn't grow up in the 70s. She came of age 30 years before in the 40s. And that gets brought along with her. And what also gets brought along with her is that hand back in vaudeville in the Yiddish theater. In that thing that was dying when she first took over the club. And the story goes that Mitzi Shore, when she had an opportunity to, took that place up on Sunset, painted it black, put a spotlight on the stage, and said, comics only. And nobody had ever done that before. There were clubs, they had comics in them, but it wasn't going to be the next thing after that stand-up of the vaudeville days. Because it wasn't specific enough. They had folk singers and they had poetry readings. And she said, funny only. Mm.
So you're known primarily, although you have played humorous roles, thinking of the character you played in Louie, and you won an Emmy for that. But you're primarily known as a dramatic actress.
I hope that I'm known as an actor.
But is it hard to do the...
Whatever that might mean.
The comedic part?
Comedy is a heck of a lot harder than... drama. I mean, any actor will tell you that at all. That intention of making the audience laugh on purpose is probably the highest of the art forms. And it was remarkable to work with the comics on our show and get to know the ways their routines, the things that seem the most offhand and slapdash and just thought of, that's the part of the routine that they have honed and honed with their friends and their mirrors and their tape recorders. Yeah. To really get that joke to sing. And all the rest of it is the sort of treading water part of it. It's a fascinating and very, very high art and also very taxing of our blessed comics.
Melissa has amazing comedic timing. And the other thing that's really interesting and really as the producer of the show, in a comedy, someone can try and make a scene funny and it will betray character. And what Melissa will never do in any scene, whether it's dramatic, funny, will betray character. She will make something really funny, but it's still Goldie. It's not an actor trying to make Goldie funny, mm-hmm. which is just a difference. The other thing that's amazing about Melissa is her dance partners from scene to scene would be a stand-up comic who had very little dramatic experience, and we had extraordinary stand-ups, and they handled such great drama because they could access it. An improv actor like John Daly, who's another brilliant mind, who's so funny, he's coming in to do a heavy drama scene with her. Or an odd, really funny scene with her, and she's now dancing with someone who's doing something kind of weird, always could ground that scene and give us a foundation that our comedians and improv actors and young actors could really shine and dance, because she created this space.
That's acting.
Yeah, acting. Yeah. Is that what they call it?
That's acting.
Good to know.
Well, so you worked with a lot of comedians, stand-up and improv comedians.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
So did they try to improv and add their own jokes
some,
in? And...
Yeah, there's some. I mean, the truth is, I think everybody on that set respects Dave Flabat. The words were so good already. Let's get those. If there's a funny thing happening and somebody wants to cut loose a little bit, great. Because it would be silly not to use the minds of some of the funniest people working and go like, yeah, we can beat that joke. Particularly with the stand-up. I mean, the other thing that's interesting is the stand-up's all written. And the stand-up is all written mostly by Dave, sometimes by Al Madrigal, who was in our writer's room, sometimes by Jerron Horton, who's another young comic. So we would let them riff there a little bit too.
So how did you make sure that you were doing 70s jokes that were funny?
That's the hardest part. I mean, if you watch a lot of the 70s material, the only stuff that exists is the shows, right? Nobody's bringing video cameras into the clubs back then. They didn't exist. So you're only watching television show, which is a little bit sanitized. We had to both be true to the time and the style of jokes and the rhythm of the joke mm-hmm. telling. We would push the edginess of it from time to time, but... Once, if I ever heard something that sounded like a UCB rhythm or, you know, a modern rhythm, we'd pull it and say, you sort of need to tell it this way, because they just weren't doing that.
Yeah. So let me play a clip of tape from Cassie. She finally gets to get on the main stage. You let her on, Goldie. And you're doubtful that she'll do well. And she's just trying to deal with the grief over the death of her ex-boyfriend.
He's Italian and swarthy. And he had these big blue eyes. Not that he couldn't be a dick, too, because he could.
God, this dick. What? For what?
Here I was, this Jew from Wink, Texas. Let me just put that in perspective for you. There's more Jews at a Walt Disney dinner party than there are in all of Wink.
So that is what you're talking about in terms of that shift to this confessional form yeah. of comedy. And she brings up this complaint saying, why don't you give me a chance? Women don't get the same kind of chances as men do in this world. This is a man's world. So how did you deal with that when you were coming to understand your character and that conflict with Cassie?
Golly sakes, it's so interesting. Again, I mentioned that Goldie comes from a time even earlier than these kids she's dealing with. And so, you know, by the time Goldie's 18, women have only just got the vote, kind of, sort of, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it's a really different world. And as I think in my mind, offering Cassie the chance of a lifetime to really live her life, whatever gender she might be.
But she doesn't think that there is this bias or that
I
she
think
needs
you
to help her because she's a woman?
I think you can't. I think what she's saying is bias be damned. Prove it.
But that do you have to work harder then to prove it?
I think that you and I and Goldie all know that. But is living your life going, man, it's a man's world, is that helping you? And there's a way to rise above it that both acknowledges that horrifying fact is true, even now today in the whatever we are, 2000s. And yet, if we keep clinging to that, we're not going to see what people are doing right now today. So I'm an advocate for moving ahead, and the realities be damned. Mm. And I hope that Goldie is bringing that into the story as well.
Melissa Leo stars in I'm Dying Up Here. Michael Aguilar produces the show. I'm Dying Up Here airs Sunday nights on Showtime. Coming up on this program, the man who defined the look that of Palm Springs has died. We'll remember William Kreisel next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. William Kreisel designed homes for the masses, and he was proud to do it. We aren't talking about the cookie-cutter stucco boxes of Lakewood or other Southern California suburbs. No, these are striking modern designs with sloping roofs, walls of glass. Think Palm Springs. Kreisel was one of the architects that defined the style there. He died on Monday in Beverly Hills. He lived in a condo that he designed. He was 92 years old. For more on Kreisel's style and legacy, I'm joined now by Renee Brown. She's Associate Curator and Director of Education with the Palm Springs Historical Society. Hello.
Hello.
Well, can you describe some of his signature designs? What did a typical Kreisel house look like?
His hallmark really was his roof lines. He designed quite a few different roof lines. The butterfly roof was probably the most well-known. They were designed to complement the mountains.
Mm-hmm. So he built for these builders, or he designed for these builders. And
he did. He had designed for the builders, George and Bob Alexander, in Los Angeles in the San Fernando Valley. And then his first project in Palm Springs was the Ocotillo Lodge, and it was a destination resort. And the Alexander's idea was that people who wanted to buy their homes could come down from Los Angeles or wherever and stay at the Ocotillo Lodge.
And how much were these homes at the time? He was building them in the late 50s, early 60s.
They did many different tracks with different price lines. Now, the Racquet Club Estates sold for $13,000 to $14,000 in 64, 65. And they were basically weekend homes or, you know, for people who came and usually didn't stay in the summer. When he started building in Twin Palms, you know, that was a little higher. And those, I think, were in the mid-20s.
Wow.
And then he built in the Las Palmas track, and that was even more than that. That was the highest.
Yeah. Still, by today's standards, a steal.
By today's standards, we're talking $40,000 or $50,000, which by today's standards, I think those homes right now are probably going for, oh my God, 900,000.
Wow.
Yeah.
I want to play a clip of tape of him describing his design philosophy. He was on NPR last year. Here he is.
A house is more than just a shelter. That is a way of improving your way of life, that it can open up a whole new concept in your feeling every day, that the indoors and the outdoors are inseparable, and that the climate and the flora and fauna and ecology are all encompassed in making your decisions on how to create this space.
So he really believed that good modern design made people's lives better, happier, more productive.
Absolutely, more enjoyable. And here in Palm Springs, we have these magnificent views, and he was very careful to set the homes in a direction where the view was intensified.
He was also known for his high design homes as well, his one-offs. One in particular, The House of Tomorrow. I just love the title of that.
Oh, yeah.
And didn't Elvis and Priscilla Presley go there on their honeymoon?
They did. They did. Now, it was actually a model home. It was built as a model home. There's nothing in the neighborhood that looks quite like it. And for some reason, the model home didn't sell, so Bob and Helene Alexander, the actual developers, lived in that house. When they lived in that house, Look Magazine did a whole spread, and that's where the term the House of Tomorrow came from. It really is a magnificent house. The master bedroom actually is at the front of the house. Everything is circular.
Hmm.
It's amazing.
So all in all, he designed how many homes there in Palm Springs?
Oh, my God. Here in Palm Springs, probably 2,000.
Oh, my gosh.
Minimum.
So he really did define the look of the city.
Well, he not only defined the look of the city, during that period of time, we'd never had mass building like that. So adding that much, you got to remember, we're a small town. You know, the Alexanders and William Kreisel and Daniel Palmer, they took us from being a village into really being a city.
I want to play one last clip of tape, and here he is speaking, sure. I think it's 2 years ago, maybe 1 year ago, to the Los Angeles Times about how he was so happy that people were now restoring his homes.
I want to not only thank the builder developers that hired me and gave me the opportunity to do it, but I also want to thank all the people of Palm Springs who understood what I was trying to do, liked what I was trying to do, and bought houses that were completely run down by previous owners and have had a love affair with these houses and completely restored them back to their original design, including the original color and landscaping. So that is very satisfying for me after all these years and a very good legacy for my work. And I know my houses are in good hands with the people of Palm Springs.
It's William Kreisel. He died this week at the age of 92. And we've been remembering him with Renee Brown. She's the Associate Curator and Director of Education at the Palm Springs Historical Society. Renee, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And thank you so much for listening. I'm Madeline Brand. I will see you tomorrow.